What's Wrong With You is the title of a new book by Dr. Sarah Holper. And the subtitle is An Insider's Guide to Your Insides. Well, Sarah, welcome to Travel Writers Radio. I don't know that we want to tip our insides out all over the microphone, but I'm sure there are people there who, in terms of the blurb for your book, would otherwise be Googling, why have I got a headache? Why have I got diarrhea when I didn't eat something bad? All those things. I guess they're questions that you've been asked a lot of being in medicine.
Graham, you are not wrong. I have answered many questions over my time working as a doctor, and this book is really the answer to all of them, plus lots of interesting facts and various things that I've learned over my years working in many different hospitals. So essentially, if you've got a body, which I presume that you do, and if you've ever been sick, which almost everyone has, then this really is the user's manual that you need.
It's an interesting concept. I haven't come across a medical text like this before, but I think you probably are onto something here. Now, your special area is neurology. Do you ever feel like the patient's just not faking it, but that it's all in their head and it's not in their insides at all?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, the first thing to say would be that there's a bit of a false dichotomy between this concept that something is in your head versus real.
Right.
For example, overseas, there isn't, in lots of countries when you train as a doctor, there's no distinction between psychiatry and neurology. They're just considered the brain and problems that can go wrong with them. So
right.
If a patient says that they've got an itch, then from my point of view, they have an itch. It's not really my role, or it doesn't really cross my mind that they might not be telling the truth. But I think that you're right. The brain is such a complicated organ. It's my favourite organ, to be fair, although it is the organ that told me to tell you that, so I am a bit biased. But it is certainly...
You have to declare an interest.
I do have to declare an interest. But it's such... We know so little about the brain that I can understand where your question's coming from.
I don't think patients necessarily are making it up, but is the brain so powerful that it can create a symptom when there, in fact, may not be a physiological problem?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So we call these functional neurological conditions. So, for example, you might have read case reports of people who've suddenly gone blind when they hear some, you know, they get some horrible news, or patients who might not be able to move their arm or their leg yet. There's no problem in the brain that we can see on MRI scans. At the end of the day, the brain is really just a complicated sort of computer system that sends messages to the body. And if it's under stress, and that stress can be, you know, being told that your house has just burnt down, that can affect the way that the brain communicates with the body and can cause symptoms. You're completely right.
So you had a bit of a short circuit. But we don't have an earthquake.
You must have been eavesdropping in my clinics, Graham. That's the exact analogy that I use. It's sort of short circuits within the brain. And the sort of software-hardware analogy that we can see on scans what's going on with the hardware. You know, have you got a tumour sitting in your brain? But there is no real way that we can see what's going on with the software, the way that the nerves communicate.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. We had a story last week. One of our reporters did an interview with... some sisters who run a restaurant in Trinidad and Tobago, and one of them was in a coma, and the rest of the sisters sang to the comatose sister and eventually woke her from the coma, and they feel like the singing had harmonic singing had something to do with that. Is that a possibility?
Yeah, it's hard to know without knowing any more of the details about the coma. But what I can say is that music in general is it's processed in a different part of the brain than regular speech. So I'll give you an example. I work a lot with patients who have had strokes, and often strokes can affect your ability to talk. But what's fascinating is that you can walk into the room and you can say, you know, Graham, how are you? And you might not be able to answer. But then if I start singing some Johnny Cash, which I am known to have done on the wards, the patient can sometimes start singing with me, singing the lyrics back at me, because that information is stored in a different bit of the brain.
Ah.
So at our hospital, we have music therapists who come around with their guitar, and, you know, if you're not into Johnny Cash, they might play some other genres, some Elvis, for example, and then the patients can just start singing. And the family members think, oh my God, like what is going on? Was mum just pretending to not be able to talk? And we say, no, the, you know, singing is a different area of the brain to talking. So in answer to your question, you know, maybe she was able to hear or to understand the singing and maybe that helped her, or, you know, it's hard to say. But again, we come back to the brain is uncharted territory.
Yeah.
Comment of before.
But stutterers can sing.
Exactly right. Oh, and you've reminded me as well with stuttering, there's a fantastic technique called voice feedback, where you wear a set of headphones that play what you're saying, but just a few seconds behind. I don't know if you've ever had that, Graham,
yeah,
where you might
accidentally
have connected to, accidentally.
It's almost impossible to talk.
It is almost impossible to talk. Yet if you give that to somebody who has a stutter,
yeah,
they do find it difficult. But over time, if you get them to read out the dictionary or whatever, they can use that distraction to help cure their stutter. So there are lots of little techniques like that you can use.
Yeah, that's actually, that sounds fascinating. Now, I read in your bio that you've been involved in research, obviously part of your medical training, etc. Just explain to me how you came to be researching which part of the brain was able to deliver the aha moment when you cracked a crossword clue. That sounds very finite.
It's pretty niche. So a bit of background, I'm a mad keen cryptic crossword solver.
Oh, right, yep.
And I've noticed that when I solve a clue, particularly when it's quite a difficult clue, that I get this really sudden and quite overwhelming feeling of aha, like this moment of insight that I've solved the clue. So I thought, well, if that feeling is so strong in my mind, surely there must be some sort of anatomical correlate or something that we can see on a scanner, or, you know, some way of actually verifying that what I'm experiencing is real, like what we were discussing before. So I contacted a professional cryptic crossword setter and managed to convince two different professors of cognitive neurology and fMRI, and managed to get free access to some fMRI facilities in Melbourne.
Yeah.
Learn a bit about fMRI coding, put together 400 different cryptic clues on a sort of a PowerPoint presentation, I suppose you could consider it, and put this crossword compiler into the scanner and just presented him with hundreds and hundreds of cryptic clues. And he'd press the buzzer when he'd solved it. And then for all of the solved clues, we analysed the fMRI data, and we could see the area of his brain that lit up when he solved a clue correctly. And we confirmed that indeed there is a little area of the brain at the front, just near where the optic nerves come in.
Shaped like a light bulb?
I reckon, Graham, if you squint and kind of turn your head to one side, it could be shaped like a light bulb.
Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating, actually. You know, and I think people love the aha moment. We've all had one, I'm sure, in some form or other.
But and in my work as a doctor, I get to give people aha moments when I explain to them what's going on. And it's such a good feeling. I mean, for example, I had a patient who, poor lady, she was about 19, and she had a patch of numbness on the outside of her thigh. And she had Googled herself and was convinced that she had leprosy. And the reason is, if you Google patches of numb skin, that's one of the top things that comes up. And as I said, she was 19. She'd been to India on her gap year, back in the days when we could travel to different countries. And so she came in to see me. She was in quite a state because she thought she had leprosy. And I said, hold on, just before we get convinced that this is leprosy, can I just have a look at this patch of skin? So she gets up on the table and I have a look, and the skin looks fine. There's nothing, there's no rash or anything. But what doesn't look fine is a few centimetres above. Her underwear was so tight, it was cutting into the skin on the side of her leg.
Oh.
And I mentioned this to her. I said, look, you know, this looks pretty uncomfortable. And she said, yeah, you know, I probably should buy some other underwear. I put on a bit of weight when I was in India. Anyway, it turns out that this patch of numbness was because her tight underwear was compressing the nerve that gives sensation to the outside of your thigh. So I gave her a bit of an aha moment when I said to her, you know, the way that your nerves work, they can't be compressed because, as you know, if you've ever woken up overnight, you've been lying on your arm.
Yeah.
If you squash your nerves, you can't feel the area that those nerves supply. So I told her to wear some looser undies. She came back to me in a week. Lo and behold, her leprosy had been cured.
Been cured, yeah. I guess you must feel like there's a lot of misinformation on the net. Well, maybe it didn't start out as misinformation, but it's open to misinterpretation and it's open to, you know, all sorts of quacks and wackos that are out there. What's your general sort of feeling about people looking things up? Does that annoy you as a doctor when they come in and they've probably spent weeks, you know, studying their situation?
It doesn't annoy me. It worries me, but it doesn't annoy me. What would probably annoy is a bit too strong, but I'd much rather have someone who comes in and they've been Googling for a week than someone who just has zero curiosity and zero interest at all in what's going on with them.
Right.
I think that humans have an innate desire to want to understand and have control about the things that are going on around them, and that includes their body. And I think that, you know, if no one's ever taught you the way that your body works, then it makes sense that you're going to go to some sort of resource, Google being the one that's nearest at hand, to answer your questions. Mm. So I think that that's a really important role of the doctor, to recognize that health anxiety and to explain to them, not in Latin with fancy diagnoses that nobody understands who hasn't gone to medical school, but to explain in English what is wrong with them, explaining how their organs work and why they're experiencing the symptoms that they are. And I think the more that doctors do that and can be trusted to do that, hopefully the less that patients will rely on Dr. Google.
And let me just, I hate to bring it up, but it seems to be all around us, the old coronavirus, or it might be coronavitis we've all got. I'm not sure if I've proclaimed a new ailment there, but you know, there is an awful lot of misinformation out there in relation to this, and even to the suggestion that the world order has gotten together to conspire against us, and you know, we're all being fed some biological weapon. Where do you sit with all of this? I mean, is there any truth to any theory that's other than you need this vaccine to help you?
Short answer, no. There is no truth to any of those conspiracy theories. But the longer answer is that this is nothing new. Humans have been resorting to magical thinking or seemingly ridiculous solutions for centuries. So let's go back to the Great Plague of London in the 1660s. Mm. People would fart into a jar and wear it around their neck. And the reason that they did that was that it was thought that the plague was due to bad air. And so the logic went like this, and I use the word logic quite loosely. Mm. If you thought that you'd been exposed to this bad air, you should immediately reach for that jar around your neck and inhale the smell of your fart, because you would dilute the bad air by your own bad air, and therefore your dose that you'd received of the plague would be less.
Oh, my God.
Okay, and then we go back even further. So in the 3rd century, there was a cure for malaria, which was to say abracadabra. That's where that word comes from. The 3rd century, it was a cure for malaria. Oh. And what you'd do is you'd write down the word abracadabra on a bit of paper, and then you'd tie it around a bit of string, again, wear it around your neck, for 9 days, and then you'd throw it in an eastward flowing river, and somehow that would cure you of your malaria. Mm. So all of this
didn't
is
work, obviously.
No, it didn't work. But if you're alive 9 days later to throw it in the river, then I suppose that you'd sort of proven you weren't going to die, so you'd still be alive to tell other people about abracadabra. Mm. But all of this to say that, you know, magical thinking and trying to come up with seemingly bizarre solutions to medical problems isn't new. And I think it's just a symptom of enormous health anxiety that plagues everyone. We want to try and explain things neatly and simply, and it really isn't that easy.
No, I understand. Well, Sarah, how would I describe your book? I suppose it's a bit like a user guide to your vehicle,
right,
or to your computer, or but people read the flaming manual, you know, that famous saying.
Exactly right. I think that, you know, we've got user's manual to vacuums and microwaves, and, you know, the human body is really just a complicated machine, and we need a user's manual for that as well. I've been through medical school. It takes lots of years, lots of horrific exams and spending long afternoons dissecting cadavers, so I figure I can spare other people that. I've written down all of the interesting stuff from medical school, put in lots of anecdotes and historical fun facts and tidbits and trivia, put it all into a book and have it ready for everyone who wants to understand how their body really works.
Well, it sounds fantastic. And so that is published by Hardy Grant, called What's Wrong With You? An Insider's Guide to Your Insides. I love that, by Dr. Sarah Holper. Sarah, thank you for being with us on Travel Writers Radio.
Thanks, Graham.
You're listening to The Travel Writers Show.